Last Thursday night, we heard the Lord begin to speak as chapter 38 began. He did not speak with the still small voice, but instead in the whirlwind, answering Job's questions about, well, 37 chapters is a lot to review, but just Job's affliction. He wondered about it. He wanted to know why, if he had been blameless as he believed he was, why? Why did God choose to do this? Why? Lots of whys, and saying, oh, if only I could go to court with him and find out, make him talk, really. And the way that God answered Job was with questions of his own. God began to ask Job things, as you remember last week that we saw in the first 28 verses, questions that Job could not answer. He asked Job things about the measurements and the process of creation of the earth. Job, why don't you tell us about that? He asked about the depths of the sea and the boundaries that had been established. If he had been the one to walk down there, if he had been the one to define the boundaries. He asked about the angels in celebration on the day of creation. He asked about the science of light and darkness. And as he went through these things, and really not just Job feeling pretty insignificant, but we ourselves as we read this and about the power of God and the understanding of God and the creation and his wisdom and the application of that wisdom, just amazing, feeling so very inadequate compared to God. You'd think, what other subjects could God possibly bring up to prove his point? And you'd think he must have exhausted the subjects. No, he certainly hasn't. And tonight, as we pick up in verse 29 of Job chapter 38, the Lord is demonstration of his awesome power and knowledge, and methods continue. And he starts out in verse 29 saying to Job, from whose womb has come the ice and the frost of heaven? Who has given it birth? Water becomes hard like stone, and the surface of the deep is imprisoned. Job, where does ice come from? Where does frost come from? Now, we might get pretty arrogant there and say, well, you know, water freezes. Yeah, but why does it get hard? Why does it stay on the top of the lake? What is the process? Why is it, you know, when you start looking at this and you say, God is challenging Job about his knowledge of ice, where it comes from and how it's formed. As simple as you think this is, ice is one of these things. It's one of the things you learned early on, that water goes into the freezer and comes out like ice cubes. Or it's like you're swimming in the lake one season and then the next you're skating on it. And it really seems very simple until you begin to really delve into the whole concept of water becoming a solid, which is ice. And why is it that it's just so? It's different from most materials in the fact that the solid, it has less mass than the liquid does, which is really odd. The density of water is really strange. You track it, and you get down to 39 degrees, and water is as dense as it's ever going to get. And somehow, between 39 and 32 degrees, suddenly it becomes much less dense. As a matter of fact, at 32 degrees, when water freezes and becomes ice, its mass then expands 100 to 111% of its size before. That's why when water gets into the cracks in your driveway and then it freezes and somehow the cracks get bigger and the roads get torn up. And that's why when you accidentally leave a bottle of water in the backseat of your car and then it freezes overnight, that it like blows up. And ice is amazing. And the more you think about it, the more you delve into it and you get into the molecular level and you say, wow, God, how did you do this? Why did you do it this way? What if it was like most other materials, that if it became denser when it was a solid, then if you think about it, the ice wouldn't stay on the top of the lake and do as the Lord asks here, or says here, that water becomes hard like stone and the surface of the deep is imprisoned? Okay, so that The surface of the deep is imprisoned. Why is it that the icebergs are floating on top of the water? Because it's less dense. Well, if it was opposite, as most materials are, the ice would sink to the bottom of the lake and would cool that water down and would subsequently freeze that. What would happen to all life in the lake would die. You see, God, if he made ice like most other materials he made, would wipe out water life. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of scientists who contend that if it was the other way around, if ice were denser than water, life on Earth could not exist. So God's saying, okay, Job, who gave birth to the ice? Go ahead and let's talk about ice. Let's play Jeopardy about ice. Ice for $100. Oh, look, God has $10,000. Job, you're still at zero. And so he continues. He says, can you bind the chains, Job? Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades? Or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth a constellation in its season and guide the bear with her satellites? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens or fix their rule over the earth? Okay, Job, let's leave the earthly. Let's stop talking about ice. Let's take a gander at the stars, Job. Let's talk about the Pleiades. Now, the Pleiades, maybe you had some sort of astronomy class or interest in. That sounds familiar to you. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you've heard of the seven sisters. It's the grouping of stars there called the seven sisters. It's interesting when you do actually find it in the sky, it looks like nine. You know, and you say, where did they come up with the seven sisters? Well, you look into it and you find out that there's seven sisters, but there's a father and a mother. So the Pleiades or the seven sisters here, Job, how much influence can you have on them? Can you restrain the Pleiades? Can you move it in any way? Can you have any influence on this whatsoever? You know, the distance that light or that stars are measured from the earth, the distance is not in feet or meters or miles. It's in light years. And the reason for that is they are so amazingly far away that the numbers would make no sense to us if we saw them in miles. And so they come up with light years. Now, you know that light travels at a speed of 186,000 miles per second. You know, now that's a car. If you're going that fast and you turned on your headlights, what would it? Oh, anyway. 186,000 miles per second. Light travels for a year at 186,000 miles per second. That distance is called a light year. The Pleiades, interestingly enough, the Pleiades is 400 light years away. And so 186,000 miles per second times 60 seconds times 60 minutes times 24 hours times 365.25 days, you do the math, that's quite a distance. It's not really in the neighborhood. Hard to influence that. Hard to have any kind of effect on it. Can you move those, Job? Can you restrain the Pleiades or can you bind the chains of the Pleiades? How about the cords of Orion, Job? Can you do anything with the cords of Orion? Now, you know, the most prideful thing I could say regarding this would be, well, I can recognize Orion. You know, have you ever seen Orion's belt? It's three pretty bright stars all right in a row. That's the belt. And then you can kind of figure out the shape from there. Orion's belt is pretty easy to spot. The stars are fairly bright compared to the other ones. You know, the one in the middle of the belt, I guess it would be the belt buckle, I don't know. But the belt buckle star, in relation to the sun, you know, when the sun's out, you can't see it because it's drowning it out. But that's only because it's so far away. In fact, that middle star in Orion's belt is 40,000 times brighter than our sun. And so it's pretty far away. It's really far away. As a matter of fact, it's 1,500 light years from Earth, as plus or minus a light month. So we can see that. He says, oh, you know, what about the cords of Orion? Can you do anything with that, Job? Or what about the bear? You know, can you lead forth the bear or can you guide the bear with her satellites? The bear, Ursa Major. You know, there's the Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, Big Bear, Little Bear. It's Latin. That's Latin, right? Ursa Major. You know, I've seen the bear all my life, and I never knew it until today. Because it turns out that the tail of the bear is the handle of the Big Dipper. I can point out the Big Dipper. Turns out that the handle of the Big Dipper is the tail of Ursa Major, and then the square of the Dipper is, it's the top back half of the bear. That's how I would really phrase that. I don't, you picture the top back half of a bear, and that's what you got. So the Big Dipper is pretty much about 25% of Ursa Major. He says, God to Job, God says, can you lead that bear? I mean, Job, let's face it, you'd have a pretty hard time leading a regular bear. So how about one that's this far away? Its main stars, incidentally, range between 62 and 108 light years away. So, Job, why don't you start walking, and when you get there, if you can get close, let's see if you can move one of them. Let's see if you can do anything with them. I think at this point, Job is probably feeling like maybe he should have never opened his mouth. But God keeps going because he wants to make sure and make the point here. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds so that an abundance of water will cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? I don't think I'd really want lightning to go forth and say, here I am. That'd be kind of scary. Who has put wisdom in the innermost being or given understanding to the mind? Who can count the clouds by wisdom or tip the water jars of the heavens when the dust hardens into a mass and the clods stick together? Okay, in drought time, Job, can you lift up your voice to the clouds and make it rain? I mean, excuse me, Mr. Cloud, it's getting kind of dry down here. Could you rain? Well, no, of course not. You can't do this. Can you do this? Can you count the clouds by wisdom? You know, I got on the internet today to look at a satellite picture just to see if I can estimate about how many clouds are over the United States today. And I figured out you really can't count clouds, number one. And then I realized, wait a second, I would have to do this with wisdom. I mean, even if I could count the clouds with the satellite, he's talking about wisdom, so I can't even pridefully do that. You know, how does rain happen, Job? Go ahead and explain to us, through your wisdom, how you can make rain happen with your voice. Now, God knew, and of course we know because we're so much very smarter now, that because of evaporation, you know, warm ocean waters evaporate and basically float up to the sky, and the moisture in the sky, if it cools down, it'll begin to condense and form clouds, possibly rain clouds. How does that happen? Has to be forced up into cooler air. So here's the wet air cruising along, and it hits a mountain range, and it gets forced up, or it hits a high pressure, low pressure front, you know, the cold front and the warm front, and the cold front pushes the warm front up, and it makes the air cooler, which causes the air to condense, which makes heavy clouds, which could possibly rain unless we want it to, and then it doesn't. But, you know, so Job, even knowing all that, what words do you think you could say to the clouds to make it rain? I mean, in the drought time and everything. I know that this year we're facing water rationing, you know, not watering the lawn and stuff. I'm actually kind of looking forward to it because I do have the deadest, worstest lawn in Sun Valley. And I'm thinking by the end of the season, we're all going to be on an even playing field again. An even brown playing field. And, you know, then I won't feel so bad. But in times like this, wouldn't it be great to be like God who could speak to the clouds and make it rain? Job, can you do that? I don't think you can, Job. If you can, go ahead and speak up here. He says in verse 39, can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens and lie in wait in their lair? So getting our feet back on the ground here, Job, let's look at the lions. They're not light years away like the stars. They're not just out of reach like the clouds. They're walking on the same dirt as you and me. Job, why aren't you feeding the lions? Job, why not? I mean, why aren't you chasing down prey for them? Why aren't you hand feeding them? Job, you know, lions are the king of the beasts, and they're called the king of the beasts because they're pretty much at the top of the food chain in their environment. They are among the highest on the food chain anywhere. They chase down quite a bit. They did surveys. They actually did like this census over 20 years in the Serengeti to find out like what the lion's top 10 foods are. Zebra was in there, buffalo, antelope, gazelle. So it's kind of like, you know, the McDonald's menu of what lions eat. They chase these things down. They eat whatever they can kill or what they can scavenge from other predators. So if you're even lucky enough to kill something, the lion comes and takes it anyway. And, you know, Job, why aren't you out on the Serengeti hand-feeding them? Well, you know, because honestly, Job, the lions would just as soon eat your hand as eat out of your hand. I think that a prideful human being, it's hard to humble him quicker than to take a prideful human being and set him in the middle of a pride of lions. Go for it, dude. What are you going to do? Well, he says, who prepares for the raven its nourishment? When it's young, cry to God and wander about without food. Who prepares for the raven its nourishment? You know, Job, the raven, not nearly as intimidating as the lion. But who's preparing? Are you preparing the food for the raven? I don't think so. And you know, we'll make it easier on you. They're omnivorous. Omnivorous meaning they'll eat anything. They really will. Ravens will eat just about anything. I used to be confused between ravens and crows. Living in Orange County, there's like, I don't know, light years of them. There's bazillions of them. There's you every morning, you know, and there's just like a dozen of them lined up on your telephone wire. They're just all over the place. And people would say, some people would call them crows and some people would call them ravens. And well, they're actually from the same species of animal. It's just the difference is that ravens are about 30% bigger. Their beaks are heavier. Their tails are in a more of a fan shape. They're bigger and they're meaner and they're louder. Well, the ravens, who's feeding them? Nobody really. There's a handful of people that will raise ravens. It's illegal, by the way, to catch one. I found that out today. And I mean, I didn't catch one, but I found out by reading that you're not supposed to keep them because they're migratory birds and so they shouldn't be caged and they go kind of insane when you keep them in a cage. The ravens are predators and scavengers. So they'll, not only are they omnivorous, but they can get their anything food from anywhere. But who's feeding them? We're not feeding them. Their young are crying out. The Lord is caring for them. Their young are crying out to the Lord. Interesting, very interesting fact. Not a lot of people know that ravens can speak like parrots can. That you've heard of parrot. Have you, anybody, what is it, Pet City or Pet Land where we went? Pet City, I think. There's this like bird that's several hundred years old there, and it's 15, but I like to exaggerate. And so this bird, you walk in and it's like, hello, and you're like, oh, that's cute. And then the cat walks by and it says, here, kitty, 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 kitty. You're like, oh wow, that's amazing. And suddenly it says, fire, fire, save the bird, you know. That's amazing. Well, you go to leave and it says, goodbye. So you turn around and say goodbye. Goodbye. See ya. Goodbye. Ah, now I'm like letting down a bird walking out of the store. I don't know if they sell anything there, but they got this bird. Well, ravens can do this same thing. However, what some people don't know that. What most people don't know is that ravens, their mental capacities, they can have vocabularies bunches of times greater than parrots can. So if that's not incentive to go catch one illegally and try and teach it, I don't know what is. But before, and the only reason I bring this up is before they can talk, when they're young, their voices are crying out to the Lord. Feed me, feed me. And the Lord cares for them. And that's what Jesus pointed out. As he would walk down the roads and use the creation as an illustration, he said to the disciples, he said, consider the ravens. You know, I could just imagine that it would probably just much like Orange County, California, where there was a bunch of them and they were making noise and they're irritating. And, you know, you could probably picture maybe like, I don't know, James and John, they were always getting into trouble. The sons of thunder, you know, they start picking up rocks. Hey, check this out. You know, they're going to throw a rock at the raven, and Jesus points to the raven. Oh, consider the ravens about how much God cares for them. Oh, put the rock back down, you know. He said, consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap. They have no storeroom nor barn, and yet God feeds them. God feeds them. God makes sure. Job, you're not feeding them. I'm feeding them. And he says in verse 1 of chapter 39, do you know the time the mountain goats give birth? I mean, that's an easy question, right? Do you know the time that the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the deer? Can you count the months they fulfill, or do you know the time they give birth? They kneel down, they bring forth their young, they get rid of their labor pains, their offspring become strong, they grow up in the open field, they leave and do not return to them. You know, long before National Geographic sent cameramen into the wild to live for months, we didn't know a lot about a lot of animals. And I think that deer were one of those animals, especially that Job couldn't have known about. Because, you know, deer calve in the November, December months. It's winter time. And they're only from the time the water bag appears, basically, until the time they're done giving birth, 2 hours. And then the young hide for like 4 or 5 days. And so you would never really see that unless the National Geographic guy was there filming it for you, hiding out in the tree or something. Job would have no clue. And it would be really hard because they didn't have the tags back then, you know, where you shoot the mountain goat with the tranquilizer, and then while it's sleeping, you tag its ear with a bright fluorescent green, you know, big old tag there. And the other mountain goats are going, you got something on your face. So, oh, yeah, well, you got leaves in your teeth. Leave me alone. And so they go. It's been a really long day. So there would be no way to track them. And yet every spring, it's interesting because the mountain goats around May or June, they kid. I don't know. They're like, guess what? I don't know what you call it, but they're kids. And it's around May or June. And the kid that they've had for the last year at that time gets the signal to go away and never come back. And so every year it's this cycle. You know, you're an empty nester for just like that. And here's another kid, literally. And he's asking Job, do you observe the calving of the deer? You know, the mountain goats, their offspring become strong, grow up in the open field, they leave and do not return to them. Job didn't know any of this stuff. He couldn't explain it, certainly not to the Lord who basically originated this whole thing. And it's just thing after thing after thing after thing. God brings up the wild donkeys. He said, who sent out the wild donkey free? And who loosed the bonds of the swift donkey? That sounds like an oxymoron to me, swift donkey. To whom I gave the wilderness for a home and the salt land for his dwelling place. He scorns the tumult of the city, the shoutings of the driver he does not hear. He explores the mountains for his pasture and searches after every green thing. The donkeys, the wild donkeys, Job, where did they come from? At this point, in the times of the patriarchs, even then, early in man's life, or early in man's history on earth, he had tamed the donkey. That you tame a donkey and you can ride it, or it can bear your burdens. And they had tamed the donkeys. They had taken them from the wild and tamed them. And you see, even like Abraham, in Genesis 22, you remember that Abraham saddled up his donkey and him and Isaac and a couple of guys went off to Mount Moriah. But even then, they were riding the donkey. They're putting saddles on donkeys. Okay, the tame ones. That's an accomplishment, Job. You can pat yourself on the back and be proud for that one. Where'd the wild ones come from? Where did the wild donkeys come from? Well, down in Colorado Springs, there's that herd of wild donkeys that wanders around town, the Cripple Creek donkey herd. They wander around and you can feed them and stuff. They're kind of wild. I mean, nobody owns them. We could say, where did they come from? Well, in that case, we know. there were tame donkeys working in the mines generations ago, and they're descendant from these tame donkeys. But where do real wild donkeys come from? Where do they come from? Only God knows. You see, there's no man alive that's seen their origins, but God has. And so he's able to say, hey, Job, you know, go ahead and tell me where the donkeys come from. You know, they don't come anywhere near the cities because the tumult of the city, the noise and I was going to say the traffic, but the foot traffic, the people, the noise. And you know, they're seeing their tame brothers getting, you know, whips on their backs, and the driver is, I mean, they have no freedom. They're being driven. And so they avoid the cities. Where do they come from, Job? I know. Do you? And then he says in verse 9, will the wild ox consent to serve you? Or will he spend the night at your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in a furrow with ropes? Or will he harrow the fields after you, or the valleys after you? Will you trust him because his strength is great and leave your labor to him? Will you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it from your threshing floor? Now, to me, this is a lot funnier than it seems. Because the wild ox here, the Hebrew word is re'em, and the corresponding verb, the Hebrew verb, means to rise. And so we know historically that this is an animal whose horns rise. In other words, whose horns point upwards. I should say horn or horns. If you have a King James version of the Bible, it says unicorn. Can the unicorn? And then in the margin, somewhere along the history of the King James version of the Bible, they put in the margin the word rhinoceros. Now that starts getting funny to me. All the newer Bible translators have rendered this wild ox. The reason they have is they say, well, what this probably is probably not the Hebrew word re'em. It's probably the Arabic word reem, R-I-M, which is wild ox. And that seems to make more sense that, you know, Job, you can't get the wild ox, you know, to pull your plow, basically. But see, you can, kind of. I mean, the tame ones came from wild ones originally. I think it's really funny to consider if the beast he's speaking of, whose horn or horns rise up, if he's talking about the rhinoceros, because that starts getting hilarious to me. And it starts making the point of God being in control and man not being in control. And so I want to go back to these few verses here and picture the rhinoceros, because it's just as accurate as wild ox. I mean, it could be. Will the rhinoceros consent to serve you, or will he spend the night at your manger? I mean, that's funny to me. Can you bind the rhinoceros in a furrow with ropes, or will he harrow the valleys after you? Will you trust him because his strength is great and leave your labor to him? I mean, can you imagine? You know, you got this plow and you're going, yeah, and there's this rhinoceros that's looking back. I'm going to kill him. I don't trust him just because his strength is great. I'm not going to have faith in him that he'll return my grain and gather it from my threshing floor. See, that to me is quality. Anyway, verse 13. The ostrich's wings flap joyously with the pinion and plumage of love. That sounds like a poem starting to happen. The ostrich's wings flap joyously with the pinion and plumage of love, and her whiteness and brightness and lightness and... Yeah. Oh, sorry. Actually, what's really funny about this, and I want you to notice this right away, is this section of scripture about the ostrich that we're beginning to read is the only part where God's talking where he doesn't ask a question. And he's not exalting the grandeur of this animal. So we'll go back and read this. It sounds like he's going to, but he's not. The ostrich's wings flap joyously with the pinion and plumage of love. For she abandons her eggs to the earth and warms them in the dust, and she forgets that a foot might crush them or that a wild beast may trample them. She treats her young cruelly as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, she is unconcerned because God has made her forget wisdom and has not given her a share of understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she laughs at the horse and his rider. Say, wow, it's like whatever day God made ostriches, he was like not really happy. And he's like, I'm going to make something that I just despise, you know. He doesn't seem to like ostriches, does he? Well, maybe he does, but he points out their behavior seems very cruel and uncaring and foolish. The ostrich's, the ostrich's wings, you know, the ostrich is like the largest bird around, and it's got wings and they flap, but the ostrich doesn't go anywhere. The ostrich will flap its wings, they're actually really strong, flap the wings to show aggression, but also to do its courting. And if you ever seen this on National Geographic, or I don't know if you can see this down at the Terry Bison Ranch or not, but I mean, they start kind of, all right, okay. Yeah, okay. I mean, they really, and that's like, you know, it's unfortunate that the tape ministry doesn't do video, you know? And the sound they make is like, hey, baby, hey, baby. Oh, anyway. So the ostrich, I've completely lost my page here. The ostrich's wings flap joyously with a pinion and plumage of love. So it's a flightless bird. It's flapping its wings to attract the opposite sex. And then after mating, you know, short time after mating, the ostrich, the female ostrich, lays an egg. And then about, like, skip a day, and the next day lays another egg. And then every other day lays an egg, 10 or 12 eggs every other day. And these eggs are huge. How many of you ever held an ostrich egg or seen an ostrich egg? Okay, so just a handful. I mean, it's more than a handful, but just a handful of people have seen an ostrich egg. Nobody on this side has seen an ostrich egg. They're massive, between 3 and 6 pounds. The contents of an ostrich egg is equivalent to 2 dozen chicken eggs. You make an omelet out of this thing, literally feeds 10 people. You try and hard boil it, 45 minutes to hard boil an ostrich egg. I'm not making that up. That's actually a fact. You're like, I don't know. How close are we to April 1st? I mean, are we making this up? 45 minutes to boil an ostrich egg. So she lays one of these eggs every other day, but the ostrich nest is an amazing thing. As he's saying here, he doesn't care. She drops it in the dust. When an ostrich makes its nest, it doesn't care where the nest is. It can be right in the middle of an elephant path. It doesn't matter. It can be right in the middle of all kinds of predators. As a matter of fact, most frequently in the wild, the ostrich, just with no covering or anything, makes the nest, lays the eggs, doesn't care if they're surrounded by predators. The ostrich is like, you know, doesn't care. Because although in the daytime she will aggressively defend the nest, at night she's like, woo, you know, running away. Any kind of nocturnal predator. That was more like a turkey, but you get the idea. Any kind of nocturnal predator can scare away this mother ostrich and decimate the nest. Step on it, crush it, eat the contents, whatever. Well, the ostrich runs away. Now, it's interesting when she said, when the Lord says this about the ostrich, about when she lifts herself on high, she laughs at the horse and his rider. Now, she gets up and she runs. An ostrich has these 2 toes, you know, and really strong legs, and takes off running. The horse and the rider, she's laughing at him. You know, the rider, if he's running, if he's an Olympic sprinter, he can get to be 23 miles an hour. Tops. And that's only for a short period. The horse, you know, the Kentucky Derby horses, the winners are average about 35 miles an hour, I guess it is. Well, the horse and his rider over a sustained period, 20 miles an hour tops. The ostrich on its 2 toes, looking very freakish, screaming and running away in fright, for a half an hour can run 50 miles an hour. So she's like, you know, you're not going to, you know, yeah, you know, come on, Silver, let's catch the ostrich. It's not going to happen. So she runs away, and the predators at night come and eat the contents. You know, they're full. They've got 10 people's omelets in their stomach now. They don't boil it because it takes too long. You know that. Well, the ostrich comes back, and it's like, huh, bummer. So it lays another egg. And then a day and a half, or 2 days later, you know, they skip a day, and the next day lays another egg. And it doesn't matter how often you run the ostrich off and decimate the nest. It'll keep doing that. It'll just come back and lay eggs. You can stomp on the eggs and it comes back. It's like the crutch all you want. We'll make more kind of thing. You remember that?
Ooh.
It was like nachos or something. Anyway, an ostrich will do this like 80 more eggs. 80. It'll do this for 160 days. That's like 4 months. For 4 months, you can smash the ostrich's eggs. It'll keep coming back and laying an egg every other day. You know how devastating it would be to us, I mean, as human beings, to lose your kid every other day, every other day, and we don't care, and we just like, whatever. Just we'll make more. Kind of like American society. Be as promiscuous as you want. Just destroy it and do it again. You need to pray for our government, by the way, that we're halfway there. Partial birth abortion is halfway to being banned in the United States. It's passed one house, it has to pass another. But you need to pray for our leaders that won't come up for a couple of months at least. You need to pray that we would have the discernment to not be like the ostrich. It's killing our children. Horrible, horrifying. God's using the ostrich. He doesn't ask any questions about this. This is pretty black and white to him. He doesn't ask any questions saying, so Job, what do you think about that? He says, look, she treats her young cruelly. She doesn't care. She lacks wisdom. She drops her eggs in the dust. He doesn't ask any questions. And he points it out and saying, you know, they really do seem to be very uncaring and foolish. If it's warm enough outside, she won't even sit on the eggs. Just, whatever. Let them warm in this hot sand. Doesn't matter. And why is God bringing this up? He's bringing this up because God has the right to create deer and rhinoceri or wild oxen, wild donkeys, ravens. He has the right to create all these things in the same way that he has the right to create the ostrich to be who she is. Seemingly cruel and uncaring and foolish, God has the right to do that. God has the right to do that. Paul told the Romans this in Romans chapter 9. As a matter of fact, why don't you turn there? It's way over in the New Testament. Romans chapter 9. It's right after the Gospels and the book of Acts. And this is a section of Scripture nobody ever turns to voluntarily when they're teaching the Bible, because it brings up more questions than it answers, and it causes more controversy than it solves. But it's the Lord's Word, and this is the way He's presented Himself. Romans chapter 9 and verse 20. On the contrary, who are you, O man, who answers back to God? The thing molded will not say to the molder, why did you make me like this, will it? Or does not the potter have a right over the clay to make from the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for common use? Now think about it. The potter is shaping the clay. It's all the same clay with inalienable human rights. But he makes one to be a vase and another to be a bedpan. And the Bible's telling us the bedpan doesn't have the right to say, why'd you make me a bedpan? Why'd you make me an ashtray? Why did you make me this? Why'd you make me that? He's a creator. Who are you, O man, who answers back to God? Now think this through, because this is challenging. This is one of the most challenging concepts in the book of Job. It's because it's way bigger than just, why do the righteous suffer? It's bigger than that. We went a step further into that saying, look, although the devil initiated it, God allowed it. God allowed it. We remember that. We've gone through this many times in our study of Job over the last couple of months. God allowed Job's suffering, even though he was blameless. But go further. God's allowed to make the ostrich as wicked as she appears to be. I've met a lot of people, and some are arrogant who say this, and some, I think, are genuinely confused. And they're confused because we're afraid to talk about this issue. When they say, well, you know, how can you believe in a God that lets millions of children starve in Ethiopia? How can you follow a God who created a place called hell where people burn for eternity? I can't follow a God and I can't believe in a God who won't heal my brother from this fatal disease. You run into that a lot. Yeah, you answer these questions a lot. And almost all the time, we begin to backpedal. And we go, oh, well, you know, you see, we're in a fallen world and this is like sin. And it's like, wait a second, God never does that. God never does that. As a matter of fact, he says, I'm God and I'm sovereign. And not only have I decided to do it this way, you don't have the right to ask me. You don't have the right to question this. Who are you, O man, who answers back to God? Well, what about the little baby boy who was born without the ability to see? And God told Moses, who has made the blind? Who has made the hearing or the deaf? Who has made the blind or who has made the seeing? It's me. God is not embarrassed about who he is or the way he's doing things. He's not. And we're always trying to make excuses for him. There's books written on how to answer this question when the reality is the question is like, you know what? God is sovereign. And rather than asking that question, you should be kind of intimidated. Rather than saying, well, I'm not going to believe in a God, you should be afraid. Because when Job started saying, oh man, you know, if I could take God to court because I didn't deserve any of this, God showed up. And now Job's feeling about this big, if that's even measurable. Who are you, O man, who answers back to God? The ostrich is the way that God made it. No questions asked. The ostrich is the way that God made it because he chose to do it that way. And he doesn't owe us an explanation. He just doesn't. But he takes credit for it, even though we would think, well, that's more like taking the blame. Call it what you want. But do it reverently, because God is God, and he's sovereign. And the Bible says his sovereignty rules over all. That means you can have all the philosophical disagreements you want with the way God set things up and the way that he's allowed them to progress. But his sovereignty rules over any of the great speeches that you might hear or the great one-liners that you might come up with. God made the ostrich. She treats her young cruelly. She runs away. The eggs are smashed. The young are eaten. And she comes back and without caring does it again. She just doesn't care. God made her that way. I don't know why. But I don't question him either. And God doesn't make excuses for it. He just says it. He also says in verse 19, do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrible. I think that could be used against me when I'm sleeping. You know, a lot of people have their own life verse. But this could be your life verse for me. His majestic snorting is terrible. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed. He does not turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him. The flashing spear and javelin. With shaking and rage, he races over the ground. He does not stand still at the voice of the trumpet. As often as the trumpet sounds, he says, aha! Aha! Okay. And he sensed the battle from afar. And the thunder of the captains and the war cry. Okay, forget the wild animals, Job. Let's talk about the horse. The domesticated, well, I don't know, domesticated, that kind of means they're living in the house. But, you know, the horse that's able to be ridden, you're riding them off to war. You think, oh, as human beings, we can take great credit for that because we learned how to put a saddle in the horse and a bit in its mouth. And you know, we... And it says, aha, and it goes off into battle, and the quiver is, boom, 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 you know, bouncing against there, and the javelin and the spear and the sword and all these things are flashing. It's running right towards the battle. It's not turning away. It's not freaking out with fear. It's going into battle. It's going, aha. Can you take any credit for any of this, Job? Did you give the horse its strength? Did you make the mane grow? When the horse jumps, and when a horse jumps, it's beautiful. It's amazing. Really, any animal at all, but the horse is buff, you know. The horse is like Arnold, you know, and it jumps. And I think if Arnold jumped, it wouldn't look as graceful as a horse. Job, you can't take any credit for any of that. You put a saddle on its back and you rode it. But you didn't give it its strength, and you didn't give it its mane, and you didn't give it the ability to jump, and you didn't instill a fearlessness in it so it'll run into battle. You didn't do any of that, Job. I did it. How about the birds of prey, Job? Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars, stretching his wings toward the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the cliff he dwells and lodges. Upon the rocky crag, an inaccessible place. From there he spies out food. His eyes see it from afar. His young ones also suck up blood, and where the slain are, there is he. Job, one last thing about nature. The hawks and the eagles, they live up on the side of cliffs, and they can see food. You know, the eagle's eye is just about as big as a human being's eye, but it's four times sharper than a perfect human eye. Four times sharper. We say, I have perfect vision. Well, what's four times perfect? Four times sharper. That means at a mile away, an eagle can see a moving rabbit. A mile away. That's amazing. That means when it's 1,000 feet in the air and it can see a mile away, it can look at 3 square miles looking for prey. That's a pretty large area. 3 square miles. It can, and when it's flying over water, it can see a fish. You know how fish are darker on the top than they are in the light most times? And even when you're fishing and you're up close, it's hard to see fish. An eagle can be several hundred feet in the air and see a camouflaged fish. So they don't go hungry much. And its eyeballs, they move into, they have 2 points of focus, so it can be like looking ahead and then checking it out. Wouldn't you be, like to be able to do that? You know, keep your eye on the road and dial the cell phone at the same time. That would be nice. And change the station, turn the CD. Oh, I don't like that song, you know. They can do that. 1,000 feet in the air, they can do that. It's hard to outfit them with CD players, though, because their batteries run out. Anyway, is talking about the hawk and the eagle, is it by your understanding, Job, that they're able to soar, that they're able to see, that their young ones are fed? And now comes the challenge from God. Then the Lord said to Job, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it. You think you have the right to reprove God, to say, I don't think things should be done this way. I demand an explanation for why this has happened. You really want to reprove God? Then you better be able to answer the questions of the last chapter. Can you answer the questions of the last chapter? No, you can't. You could spend your whole life studying science and biology and nature and watching National Geographic videos, but you still can't answer the question, have you seen the storehouses of hail in heaven? Can you speak to the cloud and make it rain during the drought? You can't do these things. If you're going to presume to reprove God and question the way he's doing things, you better be ready to have proper answers for all this. And of course, we don't. We don't. And so then Job answered the Lord and said, Behold, I'm insignificant. What can I reply to you? I'm insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once I have spoken, and I will not answer, even twice, and I will add nothing more. Job says, what can I answer? And he just puts his hand over his mouth. What can I do? What can I say? I can't. I'm insignificant. He realizes that no matter how accurate the things that he's spoken about God, about how, yes, righteous people suffer and wicked people prosper. I don't know why you guys can't see this, as he was saying to his friends. I don't understand how you can just block all that out and say, nope, it's black and white, it's just like this. No matter how many things Job said that was right, when he dared to say, if I could go to court with God and make him explain why he's done this, I would. God won't. You want to question God? I'll question you first, God says. If you're going to dare to reprove me, dare to imagine being in court with me one of these days. You know, and we do that. Sometimes we do it jokingly. You know, we knew a woman back in Oregon that one of her favorite things to say used to be, you know, one of these days, when I get up to heaven, I'm going to walk right up to Eve and just slap her in the face. Okay? Wasn't a real endearing thing to say. She said a lot. And other, you know, other times, you know, we say, you know, man, one of these days I'm going to go up to Simon Peter and go, so what did it feel like to say something really stupid? And Simon Peter will say, I don't know, how do you feel? But there's other people who say, you know, one of these days when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask God exactly what in the world was the deal with that. You know what? I'm not. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to presume to do that. And I guarantee that you won't either. No matter how many times you've said that, I guarantee you won't either. Isaiah got the chance to go up to heaven, to see the throne room of God. We sing the song of the words of Isaiah. I see the Lord seated on his throne, exalted. And the whole earth is filled with his glory. And we talk about that day of seeing God and how great it's going to be. You know what Isaiah actually said? In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory, and the foundations of the threshold trembled at the voice of him who called out. While the temple was filling with smoke, then I said, God, I want to ask you about this. Why exactly you were... Oh, no. No. Then I said, woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. I'm ruined. Who am I? I'm insignificant. I'm nothing. I realize when I see the holiness of God that I'm ruined. Job says I'm nothing. Now, he's not seeing the Lord. It's the voice of God speaking, answering from the whirlwind. And he says, behold, I am insignificant, just based on the questions he was asked. One of these days when I get to go to heaven, I'm going to go ask God exactly what, you know. Oh, you're not. Why'd you make the ostrich so uncaring? Why didn't food grow in Ethiopia? Why did you let my brother die of that fatal disease? We're not going to do any of it. And when somebody asks those questions, I think we need to be just as face value blunt as God is and say, you know, God doesn't make excuses for that. He acknowledges that there's pain and there's suffering and there's murder and there's horrible atrocities that are committed on the earth, and yet he says he's in control. And that's all I can tell you. That's all I can say. But I will tell you this, we need to follow up with, in the same way that the Bible does, I will tell you this, God loves you personally. And he sent his son to die for you personally, so that your sins, in the same way that the sinful world is falling apart around you and all these wicked people are doing wicked things to people, that wickedness can be forgiven. Your wickedness can be forgiven. Because God loves you and sent his son to pay the price of your sin. He endured the supreme wickedness of people so that your wickedness could be forgiven. And he just wants you to have faith in him and receive his son and the forgiveness that he offers. See, we need to stop making excuses for God, and we need to just start telling people the way God tells it. God doesn't excuse blindness as, oh, I missed that one. He says, I did that. Job's suffering, you remember that the Lord was ultimately the one who said, you incited me against him, Satan. He didn't make excuses for it. But he cares about Job so much, he's arriving personally and having a discussion with him. We're going to see he'll reach out to him. In the same way, God has reached out to us. No excuses for the bad things on the earth, just forgiveness for the bad things that we've done. And the God who's got everything under control, though it might not look like it, wants to have a personal relationship with each one of us. Let's pray.